1280 AM WPFP. Translator W276 DJ at 103.1 FM Park Falls, Wisconsin. Broadcasting from an old rickety shack on the shores of the Flambeau River. This is Jack FM.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. A Des Moines Register poll shows more than half of first-time likely Republican caucus-goers in Iowa support former President Donald Trump. But on the eve of the caucuses, the major question is how the weather is going to affect turnout.
With sub-zero temperatures expected tomorrow, it's likely going to be the coldest Iowa caucus night.
I've thought about not going.
So with the weather outside, do you think it's going to deter you at all from going on Monday?
No, I'm going to go.
I think it's important for everyone to go out and do their part.
According to the National Weather Service, the previous record was set in 2004 when temperatures did not get any higher than 16 degrees.
That's ABC's Sam Wynn in Des Moines. The cold weather having a national impact in Oregon, where there are ice storm warnings. The weather is being blamed for three deaths. Two Navy SEALs are missing in the Gulf of Aden off the coast of Somalia after an operation where they tried to board a ship. This is ABC News. The National Transportation Safety Board is going to investigate two crashes involving the Brightline high-speed train in Florida. It's killed three people in the last week at the same railroad crossing in Melbourne, Florida. A study published in the journal JAMA Pediatrics finds that a high number of teen girls are reporting using diet pills and laxatives.
The study analyzed 90 smaller studies worldwide, focusing on teen girls and their use of diet aids to deal with their weight. ABC News medical contributor Dr. Darian Sutton.
And they found that 1 in 10 adolescent females are using some sort of a diet supplement, a laxative, or a diuretic, which is incredibly concerning because not only can it have medical effects, but it can have lasting psychological effects.
Researchers concluded that the findings suggest interventions are needed to reduce the use of weight loss products in teen girls. Michelle Franzen, ABC News.
Experts encourage parents to watch for signs of a heightened focus on weight. I'm Brian Clark, ABC News.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Studies show more than half of the U.S. Latino population lives in states with the highest impacts of climate change. A new report outlines how that's challenging their health, their livelihoods, and their cultural legacy. Here's Mike Moe.
The report from the Hispanic Access Foundation details those impacts. Conservation Program Manager Vanessa Munoz says Latinos in every state are experiencing challenges to their mental health and identity due to climate change.
Some places might suffer severe temperatures and others might be more exposed to flooding or to a lot of wildfires, which is often where a lot of the Latino communities reside.
In Wisconsin, the DNR says communities of color often bear the brunt of air pollution and extreme weather events fueled by climate change. And state health officials say Latinos are the fastest growing racial and ethnic population in Wisconsin. According to the Pew Research Center, 71% of Latino adults around the country say climate change already affects their local community. To promote what she calls a just transition towards a climate-friendly economy for all people, Munoz says the report includes a toolkit and policy recommendations to help communities better preserve their Latino heritage.
One of the ways it's joining groups and forces to really protect our lands and prevent that from expanding, to prevent further loss and damage, which is necessary in these times of climate change.
Latinos are projected to make up 30% of the U.S. population by 2050, and over half reside in states with the highest levels of climate change threats. The Hispanic Access Foundation released its cultural erosion report at the recent COP28 conference in Dubai. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Lesson learned for the Bucks. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Milwaukee Bucks have one of the best teams in the NBA this year, but recently they went through a slump, losing four of their last five games. They may have hit rock bottom when they lost to the Jazz at home. Bucks head coach Adrian Griffin.
You know, I thought we learned from the Utah game, you know, the threes that we were giving up, and I know it. Some people think it's like cliche, but the only thing you can do is find ways to get better.
Then a few nights later, the Bucks turned things around, and they beat the top team in the Eastern Conference, the Celtics, by 33 points. Griffin on how to deal with a midseason slump.
You can't panic. You can't, you know, make excuses. You can't blame. You got to look at yourself in the mirror. We did that, and You know, from Giannis to Dame, Chris, Brooke, all those guys have been tremendous. Bobby Portis in our meetings. So, you know, we stick together.
That's the Bucks head coach, Adrian Griffin. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
This weather update is sponsored by Hansen HVAC, Heating and Cooling, your local Armstrong Air dealer of Phillips and Manitowish Waters.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Wind chill advisory in effect with wind chills as cold as 30 below zero at times. We'll see mostly cloudy skies. Our highs will average between 0 and 5 above with blustery west winds. For the overnight, mostly cloudy skies will be close to 10 below zero. It's 3 below at our studios.
You're listening to Radio Health Journal, the trusted news source for medicine, science, and technology. I'm Elizabeth Westfield.
I'm Shel Lustig.
And I'm Greg Johnson. This week, the long-term effects of nail biting.
People who have been lifelong nail biters who are really biting down by the cuticle area, sometimes their nails are very wide and it's very hard to reverse that.
But first, the technology that's taking over operating rooms.
It is life-saving and it really has been a game changer in our approach to this treatment.
All that and more this week on Radio Health Journal.
Jim Gaffigan here with some more straight talk. Let's take a moment to appreciate our sweet children, loving grandparents, and eternal soulmates. Now let's use them to save money on wireless. Because with the Straight Talk Silver plan, you get 4 lines for just $25 a month with unlimited data and no contracts. So add those human pawns, I mean loved ones, and save money. Thanks, kids. They're finally worth it. Straight Talk Wireless, available at Walmart.
Get 4 lines on Silver Unlimited for $25 per line per month, plus taxes and fees. For data management practices and additional terms, visit straighttalk.com.
The Radio Health Journal podcast gives listeners the latest news on what's trending in health, science, technology, and more.
The fact that we saw remission in 37% of patients at week 3 after just a single administration is something that's really encouraging to us.
Featuring medical experts who break down complex topics in a way that's easy to understand. Radio Health Journal podcast, available wherever you find your favorite podcasts and at radiohealthjournal.org. More than 15 million Americans getting surgery each year, according to the American College of Surgeons, it's no surprise that physicians are always looking for ways to improve the process. For example, hip replacement surgeries are one of the most common procedures in the U.S. And though rubber and even ivory were initially used as implants, surgeons now work with high-tech robots and materials to make the procedure so good, it's been dubbed the operation of the century.
Hundreds of thousands are done every year in the United States because hip arthritis is so common, probably millions every year in the world. And it's one of the most successful operations that man has ever developed. Very high success rate, but a relatively low complication rate.
That's Dr. George Heidakevich, Director of Orthopedic Trauma and Chief of Complex Joint Replacement at Orlando Health Jewett Orthopedic Institute. He says that many of the improvements over the last several decades have been centered around the materials that are used for replacements. Ceramics and titanium can now last 20 to 25 years if implanted accurately. However, a more recent innovation is technology that tells the surgeon exactly where to put the new hip, like a GPS for surgery. To achieve this precision, Heidakevich uses AI.
We're able to simulate for patients for their own specific anatomy where the best place to put that hip is. We're not able to do that before. We would assume that a certain positioning of the hip would work for everybody. And we found out that's not true. Some of those patients would have a leg length problem or a dislocation. So now we can simulate with AI by inputting some of your x-rays. The software will tell us if you're, say, a yoga instructor or a golfer or you like to play pickleball, that your hip has to be put in a certain position to the degree. And it'll tell me exactly where I should put it so you can avoid a dislocation. Then the navigation helps me hit that number accurately.
Heidakevich says this new technology is crucial for success because even the most advanced replacement won't work properly if it's put in wrong.
So you can imagine you can buy the best tire you can for your car, but if it's not mounted right, it's going to wear prematurely, right? Doesn't matter how much you spend on the tire, it has to be put in right.
This new technology allows surgeons to be more accurate than ever before, and it's quick. Heidakevich says they feed the patient's x-ray into the program 5 minutes before the procedure.
The computer analyzes your spine, your pelvis, all the anatomic variability, and we type in the type of implant we want to put in you, and it'll tell us where to put it. It's really neat. You know, before we used to guess on what we thought the best position was. Now it can tell us that it needs to be 17 degrees in this direction and 41 degrees in the other direction.
Then the AI program will even let the surgeon know in real time when they've properly placed the material. The technology is involved in each step of the way to make sure each patient leaves with the best possible outcome. Heidakevich has been using it for just over a year, and even though he's been performing this surgery for more than 25 years, he says it's made him a better surgeon.
It makes you more accurate, and that's great for my patients. I love it. Now I'm addicted to it. I can't go without it.
And hip replacements aren't the only surgery that's gotten a technological upgrade. Another invaluable innovation that's making waves in pediatric care is 3D printing. Dr. Thomas Colon is the chief of urology at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and is an expert in pediatric genital disorders as well as renal, bladder, and prostate cancers. During one of his weekly meetings, a radiologist revealed that she had been successfully using 3D models in cardiac surgeries, which got Colon thinking about his own needs.
And I said, Sue, do you think that we could do something for that with the kidney model? Because I knew that I had a case coming up of a patient of mine who had already had a kidney removed on one side, so we're dealing with a solitary kidney. So we really wanted to save as much as possible.
Childhood cancers can present differently than the adult ones many of us are familiar with. For example, a Wilms tumor is the most common kidney cancer in kids, but is extremely rare in adults.
Kidney tumors in adults are usually renal cell carcinoma. Most of those tumors are a little bit more of what we call exophytic, meaning hanging off the kidney.
Surgically removing the tumor and following it up with chemotherapy has proven to be really successful against Wilms tumors, but there still aren't any prevention methods. In fact, some kids who are more susceptible to forming kidney tumors will develop another tumor in the other kidney. Because of this risk, surgeons have begun to do organ-sparing surgery, which means they try to save as much of the kidney as possible instead of removing the entire organ. But it's not as simple as it sounds.
These tumors, you know, start out extremely large and are extremely invasive. And there's a lot of critical structures in these little kiddos in the kidney and nearby to the kidney. We don't want to think of pediatric patients as just little adults, because they're not, and they have very different problems. And we approach disease processes and certainly approach surgery in a different manner than we would adults. And so all around, that makes things a little bit more difficult.
Which is why 3D printing can make a huge difference. A life-size 3D model is created from MRI scans, first as a PDF image on the computer, and then as a handheld model that Colon can practice with before operating on his patient.
The bottom line to that is it allows me to, in the midst of surgery, know that I've been here already. I've already had practice with this. I already really know what to expect. And it allows us to plan beforehand. I mean, there are very few things in life that you go into without having a really good roadmap or a good plan. And it allows me to know what my approach is going to be, how far into the kidney I need to go to safely remove all of the tumor and not disturb any of the other critical blood supply, really, that we need to save the rest of the kidney.
One of the first times Colon used a 3D printed model was in preparation for a patient who had already had one kidney removed, but then developed a tumor on the remaining one. Colon had an exact model of the patient's kidney 2 weeks before the surgery, able to look at every angle to find the best approach for tumor removal.
Then when I was actually operating, even though I could not see all of the vasculature, I could see one part of it that I knew, because I had previously had this model in my hand, that this was the arterial supply to just that part of the tumor. Then I was able to early ligate that, tie that off and separate that, and then really save the kidney and remove the tumor, and the patient is doing wonderfully.
That was a few years ago, and Colon says the success has only grown.
It allowed us to really do much more complex surgery than we ordinarily would have been able to. It really has been a game changer in that regard. We've even used it in helping to plan and change surgeries in pelvic reconstruction. cases where we have to reconstruct the bladder or close the bladder because the bladder is open to the skin, and it's called bladder extrophy, and looking at ways that we can change the pelvis and the angle, and so we can almost kind of practice, if you will. Children can be born with the urinary system, genital system, and anorectal system all connected. And in little girls, there should be three separate openings, and they can all be connected, and they can be at various levels, and sometimes really connected just close to the skin or up much higher. And it's helpful in those cases too, because no patient is the same as the previous one. And we really need to know that anatomy as best as possible to be able to have the best outcome for the surgery.
Though it used to take around 2 weeks to create the 3D printed version, Colin says his team has gotten it down to just a couple of days. These models have transformed cases that were previously thought to be inoperable into success stories.
It's exciting research. It is exciting to go beyond the care of what we were giving before and really advance medical treatment for these patients. And it really, you know, it is life-saving, and it really has been a game changer in our approach to this treatment.
But just like with all discussions around AI and advancements in technology, we always have to wonder what could go wrong. What happens if an extra vein is printed into the model or the computer's coordinates are an inch off? Hadakevich says surgeons need to stay alert and recognize that these innovations are tools to enhance the operation, not lead it.
If you've ever been in a car and a navigation tells you to turn left and there's a lake to your left because the inputs are old or doesn't have an updated map, we've all had navigation lead us astray. So the surgeon needs to be comfortable with traditional hip replacement to know when the machine isn't correct so you can question it, because sometimes it's wrong and you need to recognize it's telling you to do something that's not accurate. So I think that's a caution to all surgeons adopting the technology, is double check it with your own experience to make sure where it's telling you makes sense.
Hadakevich has experienced this firsthand. He unknowingly input inaccurate points for the patient's anatomy into the AI program, which then told him to place the new hip about 10 degrees off of where it should have been.
And I looked at it and said, well, I can't put it there. It doesn't make sense. So then we brought in the x-ray and just checked it and verified, redid the registration, and it was correct. It's like the saying is garbage in, garbage out. If you put the wrong data in and the computer gives you an answer that's wrong, whose fault is it? So you got to have the accurate information, accurate x-ray inputs on the way in, and then it'll guide you right.
Even with kinks like this one still needing to be worked out, Hadakevich believes medical technology will continue to evolve, and eventually it will be embedded into every part of the operating room.
Every drill, every saw blade we use will have some array on it to tell me what degree or how deep I'm drilling or what have you. So I think we'll have these smart tools that will allow us to still be surgeons. You know, it's not going to be some metal robot doing your surgery. There'll be a human there with their hands on the instruments, but we'll be guided with much more precision than we have been in the past.
So my goal with all of this, and if we're really looking into the future, it's really VR and AR, you know, so it's virtual reality and augmented reality. I do believe that that is the future for organ sparing surgery.
Researchers have already begun to 3D print everything from bones and blood vessels to muscles and many organs. And though none have been approved for human use just yet, these capabilities may soon change medicine as we know it. You can find more information about Dr. George Hadakevich, Dr. Thomas Colin, and all of our guests on our website, radiohealthjournal.org. For more behind the scenes, follow Radio Health Journal on Facebook, Instagram, and X. Our writer-producer is Kristen Farah. Our executive producer is Amira Zaveri. I'm Elizabeth Westfield.
Coming up, why do we feel the need to bite our nails? When Radio Health Journal returns.
Getting vaccinated with Prevnar 20, a Pfizer vaccine.
So am I, because I'm at risk for pneumococcal pneumonia.
If you're 19 or older with chronic conditions like asthma, diabetes, COPD, or heart disease, or are 65 or older, you are at increased risk for pneumococcal pneumonia. Ask your doctor or pharmacist about Prevnar 20, pneumococcal 20-valent conjugate vaccine. It can help protect you against pneumococcal pneumonia in just one dose.
Even if you've already been vaccinated with other pneumonia vaccines, Prevnar 20 may help provide added protection. Prevnar 20 is approved for adults to help prevent infections from 20 strains of the bacteria that cause pneumococcal pneumonia. Continued approval may depend on a supportive study. Don't get Prevnar 20 if you've had a severe allergic reaction to the vaccine or its ingredients. Adults with weakened immune systems may have a lower response to the vaccine. Side effects include pain and swelling at the injection site, fatigue, headache, muscle, and joint pain. For full prescribing information, please call 1-855-213-2138 or visit Prevnar20.com.
Most people have a bad habit or two. Many of them are established in childhood and carried around throughout life. For example, a surprising number of people bite their nails, according to Dr. Dana Stern, assistant clinical professor of dermatology at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York.
It's shockingly common. And in fact, when I first came across this statistic, I was surprised. It's about 20 to 30% of the general population. And this statistic may actually be low because we really think that the prevalence is likely underestimated because patients are often embarrassed to seek help for this condition.
Just like any habit, nail biting occurs in varying degrees. Some people may just chew off hangnails. Others are chronic biters who tear at their cuticles and the skin around their nails, causing terrible damage. But why do we bite our nails in the first place? Dr. Fred Penzel says it may be linked to evolutionary grooming behaviors. Penzel is a psychologist and executive director of Western Suffolk Psychological Services in Huntington, New York. He focuses his work on habits he calls body-focused repetitive behaviors, like skin picking, hair pulling, and nail biting.
All these things, as I say, have some relationship to grooming behaviors. However, they were never meant to go as far as they go when it becomes a disorder, basically. So all these things have their roots in evolution and early types of behaviors. They say all people do a certain amount of them, but for the majority of people, they don't become problematical or don't turn into disorders in their own right.
But for people who bite beyond what's normal, their nails are visibly different.
You basically tend to see an abnormal short, uneven nails. Oftentimes, the cuticles are affected. Biting can occur anywhere along the length of the nail. So the cuticle is the nail's protective seal at the base of the nail, and it's a very crucial anatomical structure.
Person may have infections, they may have skin damage or, you know, nail bed damage, things like that, or it causes scabs and bleeding and kind of unsightliness and causes social problems, you know, to the point where the person's keeping their hands behind their back or in their pockets when they're around other people because it creates like a sort of social embarrassment in addition to, you know, these medical and other problems.
As Penzel mentioned, infection is a major concern for extreme nail biters. The constant contact between the mouth and open wounds around the nails can lead to a variety of health problems, especially when the cuticle is damaged.
The cuticle is essentially what prevents everything from entering the nail unit. And so lots of biters like to kind of pick and tear at that structure, and that can wreak havoc in a lot of ways. It can actually result in secondary infections, things called paronychias. And there are actually two types of paronychias. One is caused by yeast and one is caused by bacteria. And what is crucial to understand with respect to nail biting is that our oral flora, the kind of bacterial ecosystem in our mouth, so to speak, is kind of in a well-balanced state within our mouths. But when we stick our fingers in there, our nails will kind of take on organisms that are not supposed to be lingering and entering the nail unit.
Nail biting can cause other injuries and damage to the nails as well.
You can develop something called a splinter hemorrhage, which is these little black longitudinal streaks within the nail that are actually blood that collect in the grooves within the nail bed. And those are a direct result of trauma. Basically, what's happening is the nail biter is essentially crushing the little capillaries and blood supply within the nail bed, and then the grooves within the nail bed fill with blood and it looks like a black splinter. You can also develop other abnormalities such as punctate leukonychia, which are white spots throughout the nail. Those are very common in children.
Stern says it's even possible for someone with a history of oral herpes to transfer that to their nails. That's called herpetic whitlow. You'd think with all these complications, people would try hard to quit. But it's not that simple.
You're trying to satisfy a need within your nervous system, which is pretty powerful. You know, it's like there's usually, let's say, some mechanism that regulates levels of stimulation within the nervous system. And in this case, in these folks, it's not working very well. So it's very hard to resist. Your nervous system wants what it wants, basically. And nails are always there. So is hair and skin. They're always available. You can always use them for this purpose.
Penzel says chronic nail biters seem to have no control over their biting, but resources like a therapist can help those who can't seem to break the habit.
If it's serious enough, probably need to work with a specialist, you know, a therapist who's trained and has experience in treating disorders of this kind, because first of all, you need to do a very careful behavioral analysis of it to understand all the triggers and all the inputs that generally lead to a person doing this. And then you have to either eliminate those triggers or control them in some way or modify them or find substitutes. So it's, as I say, it's a very comprehensive kind of therapy, and you really need someone who has experience in doing this. You know, people may try one or two little techniques that they've heard about, but it won't be enough to overcome a problem that's become quite serious and become very pervasive.
Once people quit biting their nails, obviously it stops infection and further damage, but sometimes it may be too late.
People who have been lifelong nail biters who are really biting down by the cuticle area, sometimes their nails are very wide and it's very hard to reverse that. Sometimes the nails will actually develop pigment from biting. So what happens is the nail biter has kind of these black to brown to gray longitudinal streaks in the nail. And the reason that occurs is because the nail actually has melanocytes, which are the melanin producing cells. And typically those cells are not producing pigment. They're kind of sleeping, they're dormant. But when they get stimulated, and trauma is the number one stimulus in the nail of these melanocytes, they wake up and start producing pigment, and it appears as these brown to black stripes. And those can be, even once the nail biting stops, those can take years to fade, and sometimes they don't end up fading. The melanocytes are just permanently stimulated.
This sort of permanent damage is why it's important for people who are chronic biters to seek help to get over what's more than just a bad habit. You can find more information about Dr. Dana Stern, Dr. Fred Penzel, and all of our guests on our website, radiohealthjournal.org. For more behind the scenes, follow Radio Health Journal on Facebook, Instagram, and X. This segment originally aired September 2021 and was written by Morgan Kelly. Our lead producer is Kristen Farah. Our production manager is Jason Dickey. I'm Greg Johnson.
Radio Health Journal returns in just a moment.
Denise has been playing jazz for 40 years. Last concert, one of the musicians fell sick with RSV. Respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, is a highly contagious virus that can lead to breathing problems. This time, she's choosing to help protect herself with Pfizer's RSV vaccine, Abrysvo. Abrysvo is a vaccine for the prevention of lower respiratory tract disease caused by respiratory syncytial virus, RSV, in adults 60 years of age and older. Abrysvo is not for everyone and may not protect all who receive the vaccine. Don't get Abrysvo if you've had a severe allergic reaction to its ingredients. People with a weakened immune system may have a decreased response to Abrysvo. The most common side effects are tiredness, headache, pain at the injection site, and muscle pain. Ask your pharmacist or doctor about Pfizer's RSV vaccine, Abrysvo, respiratory syncytial virus vaccine. For full prescribing information, please call 1-844-989-7284 or visit abrysvo.com. Brought to you by Pfizer.
The Radio Health Journal podcast gives listeners the latest news on what's trending in health, science, technology, and more.
The fact that we saw remission in 37% of patients at week 3 after just a single administration is something that's really encouraging to us.
Featuring medical experts who break down complex topics in a way that's easy to understand. Radio Health Journal podcast, available wherever you find your favorite podcasts and at radiohealthjournal.org.
Jim Gaffigan here with some more Straight Talk. Now you can get a Walmart Plus membership, plus not pay for it, because it's included with Straight Talk wireless plans. You get free delivery with Walmart Plus, plus a Paramount Plus subscription included. Plus, you pay less for gas. That's a lot of pluses.
Only Straight Talk gives you unlimited 5G data and Walmart Plus included on select plans for free.
Straight Talk Wireless, available at Walmart.
Requires service on Gold or Platinum Unlimited. One offer per eligible account. Paramount Plus Essential Plan only. Separate registration required. Additional terms apply.
Medical notes this week. How can surgical patients recover without opioids? There's been a decline in surgery-related opioid prescriptions since 2016 in an effort to combat addiction. And while the numbers are still in a downward trend, a study in JAMA Network Open reveals that the progress has slowed significantly since COVID. While experts say surgeons shouldn't eliminate opioid prescribing altogether, there needs to be a clear focus on accurate and necessary opioid prescriptions. How do you fix a broken heart? Some researchers think radiation may be the answer. A study in the journal Med examined how low-dose radiation therapy affects mice with heart failure. The findings suggest that damaged hearts with high levels of inflammation could benefit from this process by removing the inflamed cells from the muscle. The scientists plan to continue this research to see if this option would be effective in human hearts. A new form of pain relief for amputees. Many people experience phantom limb pain after losing a leg or a foot. The condition doesn't always respond to pain medication and often impacts a person's quality of life. Thankfully, new research in Nature Biomedical Engineering shows how spinal cord stimulation can alleviate this ache. The process restores sensory feedback to the limb, which also helps improve balance and mobility. And finally, virtual reality can help people with autism. VR gives users the opportunity to experience social situations in a safe and comfortable setting. Experts believe this capability can help neurodiverse learners practice skills and become acclimated to situations before entering the real world. Scientists think this technology can be adapted into different learning environments such as special education classrooms. The findings are published in the journal Computers and Education X Reality. And that's Medical Notes this week. I'm Shel Lustig.
Denise has been playing jazz for 40 years. Last concert, one of the musicians fell sick with RSV. Respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, is a highly contagious virus that can lead to breathing problems. This time, she's choosing to help protect herself with Pfizer's RSV vaccine, Abrysvo. Abrysvo is a vaccine for the prevention of lower respiratory tract disease caused by respiratory syncytial virus, RSV, in adults 60 years of age and older. Abrysvo is not for everyone and may not protect all who receive the vaccine. Don't get Abrysvo if you've had a severe allergic reaction to its ingredients. People with a weakened immune system may have a decreased response to Abrysvo. The most common side effects are tiredness, headache, pain at the injection site, and muscle pain. Ask your pharmacist or doctor about Pfizer's RSV vaccine, Abrysvo, respiratory syncytial virus vaccine. For full prescribing information, please call 1-844-989-7284 or visit Abrysvo.com. Brought to you by Pfizer.
Thank you for joining us this week and every week as we break down the science stories you need to know. You can find all of our past segments and guests on our website, radiohealthjournal.org, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and X for daily content, and tune in next week for another edition of Radio Health Journal.
Retirement can be scary, but only if you're not prepared. That's why AARP created thisispretirement.org. Because unless you've already retired, you're in pretirement and you still have time to plan. Learn about retirement savings options, potential tax breaks, and how you can build savings over time. Visit thisispretirement.org for free resources to help you customize your action plan and feel the retirement fear disappear. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
What's your go-to when the cold winds of winter blow? A heavy coat? A hat? For many of us, it's lip stuff, too. But did you know one of the most popular brands, Carmex, the one in the little yellow tube or tub, is a Wisconsin product? It's made in Franklin, a suburb of Milwaukee, and it's shipped to more than 60 countries every year. So can you guess the original use for Carmex? Fixing squeaky doors, actual lip balm, or to soften baseball gloves? The answer coming up. Alfred Woolwig created Carmex in the kitchen of his Dodge County home in Rubicon in 1937. He hand-poured thousands of jars until deciding to automate the manufacturing process in the 70s. Now, can you guess the original use for Carmex when it was created more than 80 years ago? It's always been meant to be a lip balm, but people use it on other dry or itchy skin areas too. It remains a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
This weather update is sponsored by Hansen HVAC, Heating and Cooling, your local Armstrong Air dealer of Phillips and Manitouish Waters.
This week on Viewpoints.
One of the things that is so important about science fiction is this confrontation with the present.
We cover an author who's paved the way for greater diversity in science fiction. Then,
they're a perfect democratic society. They take everybody's input and then they make a group decision and they thrive by each doing a little tiny bit of contribution and work.
We dive into the fascinating inner workings of bees. I'm Marty Peterson.
And I'm Gary Price. These stories in depth this week on your public affairs magazine, Viewpoints.
And now another no-brainer money-saving tip from Progressive.
It looks like your luggage is over 50 pounds. Is there anything you can take out?
Oh, yeah. Let me just toss all these $20 bills.
Great. Let me grab you a trash can.
Stop. Instead of throwing money away, move some clothes into a carry-on. And here's a better tip from Progressive on how not to waste money. Don't pay too much for car insurance. Drivers who switch and save could save hundreds. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
What's that sound? That's the sound of Downy Unstoppable scent beads going into your washing machine and giving your clothes freshness that lasts all day long. There it is again. It's like music to your ears, or more like music to your nose. That freshness is irresistible. Let's get a Downy Unstoppables bottle shake. And now a sniff solo. Nice. Get six times longer lasting freshness plus odor protection with Downy Unstoppables in wash scent beads.
Not too long ago, science fiction was a genre completely dominated by white, male authors. And what's more, the characters reflected that demographic. However, today, readers enjoy a far more diverse universe due in large part to the first widely successful female African-American science fiction writer, Octavia E. Butler.
Historically, a lot of production was white male dominated. And if you think of Butler's life in particular, she was somebody who, you know, struggled to just make ends meet. She was working all sorts of factory and service jobs, getting up at 2 a.m. to write, trying to find a big break that only came for her fairly late in her life when she won the MacArthur Grant. For most of her life, she was the only black woman who was making a living writing science fiction and is widely credited for the explosion of particularly black women science fiction writers that we have now, but as well as just diversifying the genre in general, and has been an amazing inspiration to many of the best writers working today.
That's Jerry Canavan, assistant professor of 20th and 21st century literature at Marquette University and author of Octavia E. Butler, an installment of the Modern Masters of Science Fiction series. According to Canavan, few sci-fi authors before Butler and another science fiction writer of color, Samuel Delaney, ever imagined a world where blacks, Hispanics, or Asians might also live. Even Butler's editors at one time raised objections to her writing about characters of color unless they were purple.
Both Butler and Samuel Delaney had lots of versions of this question that they encountered from different types of editors who felt that they shouldn't include people of color in their science fictions because then the entire story would become about race rather than about the ideas or about the future or about the technology or anything else. So once you inject race into the story, the history of white and black in the real world, people can't think about anything else. And her position in the piece we excerpt in my book is that, well, let's think about those things. Why should we stop thinking about those things? They're very important and they matter.
Butler addressed this issue in a seminal article titled Lost Races of Science Fiction.
She's writing about this difficulty she had in kind of interjecting herself into science fiction as a genre that didn't necessarily want to talk about race very much. And if it did, it wants to allegorize it as being about purple aliens from some other planet. And so she didn't like this kind of sense of erasure at all. She said, you know, we need to talk about real issues in science fiction, including race. You can't just erase this question. And so much of her work was in part about writing herself and people like her into a future that didn't necessarily have a ton of place for them.
For example, in her most famous book titled Kindred, she writes about time travel.
She's writing in part about how different it is for a black woman to go back in time than a white man. A white man can go back in time and kind of see the past as an empty space to be conquered or a way to use his knowledge of the future to gain advantage. But a black woman who goes back in time sees herself at risk of being enslaved. So that story kind of turns time travel fantasy on its head in this kind of incredibly clever way. And so much of her stories do that. She has a vampire novel. She has an alien invasion novel. She has a kind of novel about mutants who take over the world in the future. And in all of these stories, you see how her status as a black woman transforms what are otherwise the kind of obvious assumptions of science fiction in a way.
Canavan says thanks to Butler, the genre has made progress toward diversification.
We're kind of getting away finally from this assumption that everything has to be anchored from the perspective of white men. And you also see a science fiction genre that is now able to, you know, in some fundamental way, market itself to populations that aren't white and male. And so some of the projects that she worked on in her life, like she had attempted to put together an anthology of black science fiction writers, and it never came together for a variety of reasons. Now we see this kind of proliferation of writers, of not just black writers, not just writers of color, but writers from all kind of orientations and identity categories now being able to publish their science fiction.
The African-American female writer N.K. Jemisin has won 2 Hugo Awards back-to-back, the first time any author has done that in 25 years. Butler herself won all the major awards in science fiction, including the Hugo and Nebula Awards.
So you're seeing this kind of explosion of interest in diverse perspectives that's getting better and better. It's not quite to where parity would be, but there's been a massive improvement. I think if Butler were still alive, she'd be really amazed. We're also seeing finally some of Butler's work being optioned for television, including her series Dawn.
In her work, Butler grapples with the concept of otherness and explores how people with different ideas and different orientations can come together.
Across science fiction history and her stories too, when you meet the aliens, you don't know if you're going to murder them or make love to them, right? I mean, that's like the classic kind of Star Trek paradigm, and she was a big Star Trek fan and loves those kinds of stories. And so there's this desire to encounter something that's truly different from you, and also this kind of terrified fear of what it would mean to meet something different or to become something different. And so many of her stories are dealing with that.
The popularity of blockbuster franchises like Star Wars, Star Trek, and Guardians of the Galaxy proves that the world loves science fiction. Fans love to speculate about what human societies in the future or in alternate worlds might be like. But it's the characters we love that make the stories relatable.
One of the things that is so important about science fiction is this confrontation with the present, right? This sense that, you know, since the Industrial Revolution and the various technological revolutions that have come since, we're constantly trying to catch up to the present, right? It seems the world is changing so often, and science fiction gives us a vocabulary to think about that. So the ideas are certainly important, but without the characters and that kind of one-to-one identification that people get, you really don't have a genre that functions, right? I mean, characters are so important, and that's why the diversification and representation of these stories is so important, that finally all sorts of different people can kind of see themselves in the future in a way they hadn't been able to before. And that's what was so important to Butler and the other Afrofuturist writers, to depict a future that wasn't just all white and all male.
Even though Butler died in 2006 at the age of 58, her work constantly attracts new readers.
She seems to speak so directly to our present that I think people really are constantly discovering her. Every day on Twitter, I see new people finding her and having their minds blown.
To learn more about this topic and our guest, Jerry Canavan, head to viewpointsradio.org.
For more behind the scenes and to support our show, follow Viewpoints Radio on Instagram, X, and Facebook. This segment originally aired in May 2019 and was written by Polly Henson. Our executive producer is Amira Zaveri. Our studio manager is Jason Dickey. I'm Gary Price.
Coming up, we speak with a fifth-generation beekeeper about the trade and what humans can learn from bees when Viewpoints returns.
Jim Gaffigan here with some more straight talk. Let's take a moment to appreciate our sweet children, loving grandparents, and eternal soulmates. Now let's use them to save money on wireless. Because with the Straight Talk Silver plan, you get four lines for just $25 a month with unlimited data and no contracts. So add those human pawns, I mean loved ones, and save money. Thanks, kids. You're finally worth it. Straight Talk Wireless, available at Walmart.
Get four lines on Silver Unlimited for $25 per line per month, plus taxes and fees. For data management practices and additional terms, visit straighttalk.com.
It's game day at Jim's house, and the spread is impressive.
Mike's already done some damage with the hot wings, and now he's dropping back and going deep for another slice of pizza.
I sure hope he brought the Pepto.
Mike knows the Pepto-Bismol provides fast, five-symptom relief from unexpected stomach upsets. He's no rookie.
The way he's throwing back those nachos, he's the GOAT.
Be ready for game day with Pepto-Bismol.
When you have nausea, heartburn, indigestion, upset stomach, diarrhea.
Use as directed. Keep out of reach of children.
Denise has been playing jazz for 40 years. Last concert, one of the musicians fell sick with RSV. Respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, is a highly contagious virus that can lead to breathing problems. This time, she's choosing to help protect herself with Pfizer's RSV vaccine, Abrysvo. Abrysvo is a vaccine for the prevention of lower respiratory tract disease caused by respiratory syncytial virus, RSV, in adults 60 years of age and older. Abrysvo is not for everyone and may not protect all who receive the vaccine. Don't get Abrysvo if you've had a severe allergic reaction to its ingredients. People with a weakened immune system may have a decreased response to Abrysvo. The most common side effects are tiredness, headache, pain at the injection site, and muscle pain. Ask your pharmacist or doctor about Pfizer's RSV vaccine, Abrysvo, respiratory syncytial virus vaccine. For full prescribing information, please call 1-844-989-7284 or visit Abrysvo.com. Brought to you by Pfizer.
Year between spring and summer, we have swarm season, a unique yearly rite of passage for hundreds of thousands of bees.
Swarm season is when bee colonies naturally divide, and that's when you'll see a huge cloud of bees in the air, or when they hang in a big cluster off a tree branch or the eave of your house. And that's when our phone would ring all the time with people calling with swarms in their yards. And so that was fun.
Meet Meredith May, award-winning journalist and author of The Honey Bus, a memoir of loss, courage, and a girl saved by bees.
We would have to drop everything and hop in the truck and race to go get them because they don't hang that long in between homes. A swarm is on its way to a new home that it's discovered. So you have to catch them in time. So it's looks really dramatic, but it's actually a really safe time to handle bees. You have to bring an empty hive box, and you have to reach the swarm either by a ladder, or sometimes when you're lucky, it's within reach. And you can just saw the branch off or shake the bees into the box. The trick is you've got to get the queen, because once you have the queen, all the bees will come to her. And the reason they're easy to handle at that time is because they've eaten a lot of honey in preparation for their trip, so they're very full and lethargic, and they're less likely to sting you.
May was a little girl at the time, living in Big Sur, California, with her grandmother and grandpa, who was a fourth-generation beekeeper.
I was four. My little brother was two. We lived in Rhode Island because my dad was in the Navy. My mom is very volatile. I remember a lot of dishware flying in the house. So it was after one of these big fights, shortly thereafter, I was on a plane. And when the plane landed, we were in California, and we being my mother, my brother, and I, my dad stayed behind. we moved in with my grandparents, and the three of us moved in my mother's childhood bedroom, and that's where we were for pretty much the next decade. That was our living arrangement.
Her mother spiraled into major depression and basically didn't get out of bed for the next several years. May draws many parallels to her life as a child and the behavior of bees.
When the queen leaves, the bees become visibly anxious. Like within 10 or 15 minutes, they'll start to smell the queen pheromone is gone. And they'll get really visibly agitated, and you can see it. They look like they're itchy, and they shake, and they run around. They're actually looking for her. So hives have personalities, and they also have moods, and you can sense this and see this. So, for example, I can open a hive that was comfortable, humming along, not aggressive 1 week, and then the next week I open it and it's totally different, and I can say, I think they lost the queen just by the way that they're behaving.
Though she and her brother ran wild and got into plenty of trouble, the world of beekeeping mesmerized May from the moment she first arrived at her grandparents' home.
The honey bus is an old World War II army bus, and it's green and it's rusting from the rain, and there's no engine in it, and it's permanently marooned in Grandpa's backyard. And that's his honey house. He gutted it. He took all the seats out and he put his honey factory inside. That's where he bottles honey. And it was kept locked to keep little hands out of it. And I was just fascinated by it. I wanted to see what it was like in there. Grandpa would work in there at night, or really all day into the night, and his friends would join him from Big Sur, and I would sit in the weeds and kind of watch and just watch them laughing and making honey and drinking beer. And it held like this Willy Wonka fascination over me. I wanted to see what was going on in there.
You've probably seen beehives while driving in the country. They're those stacks of white boxes standing in a field or under trees. One stack is one colony, and each colony has one queen. A beekeeper inspects beehive frames to make sure the queen is healthy. May says she's easy to spot because all the worker bees huddle around her like petals on a daisy.
Bees have various jobs inside the hive, but all the jobs are done by female worker bees. The male drones don't do anything. Their job is just to mate occasionally. So what you're looking at are female bees keeping a protective circle around her. It's kind of like parting the crowds for a rock star. So they're just making sure she can walk around and find a place to lay an egg, and they feed her and bring her water. She can't feed herself, so they make sure she can eat, and they keep her warm at night. They cuddle her. In a beehive, it holds 8 frames per box, and the 2 bottom boxes are bigger. That's where the nursery is. That's where the queen lays eggs. So she's going to be in one of the 2 bottom boxes. I know at least that much. So I have 16 frames to look at to find her. The boxes above the nursery are a little shorter, and those are called honey supers, and that's where their pantry is. That's where they store their honey.
May learned many life lessons from bees, like what unconditional parental love and generosity look like.
One time we were beekeeping and it started to rain, and we had one of those nursery frames in our hand. It was honeycomb with eggs inside the honeycomb. All of a sudden, all the nurse bees, whose job it is to feed the babies, all of them lined up, all facing the same direction, and they interlocked their wings. And it looked like a corn cob. And they were protecting the eggs from the rain. And their wings were connected like Spanish roof tiles. It was the most amazing thing. Like, how did they communicate that to each other? How did they do it so quickly when our eyes were off of them for a second? And that they put themselves in harm's way for the babies, I think, was a beautiful thing for me to see. It's the exact opposite of a dysfunctional family. That's why I loved it as a kid.
Tragically, today's industrial, large-scale beekeeping creates dysfunctional, stressed-out bees. Besides pesticides, May believes it's another reason bees are in big trouble.
People who have thousands and thousands and thousands of hives put them on semi-trailers and truck them around the country following the bloom at, you know, major orchards. And it's stressful for the bees to be constantly moving because each time they're put in a new farm, they have to reorient and figure out where they are. And then they're forced to pollinate a monocrop. So imagine you or I having to eat a hot dog every day for a month and then having to eat a hamburger every day for a month, and we'd get sick too.
May's grandfather sought to be of service to the bees, to provide a sanctuary for them, and to only take their honey when there was a surplus.
If you treat them well, you will get a bountiful surplus because bees have OCD. They work so hard. But one of the criticisms my grandfather had of industrial large-scale beekeeping that I share is that man has this propensity to take nature and force it to work for him or her. And when you do that, you destroy the thing that's bringing you joy and money, and it never works out well in the end.
There are many books on the market about how to raise bees. May wanted to write something different.
Obviously, we can't lose our bees when they pollinate a third of the food grown on the planet. I mean, people understand that. And I didn't really want to repeat that conversation, but what I wanted to talk about was the moral necessity of bees. Their social structure, the way they care for one another, has not changed over the last 100 million years, so they must be doing something right. They're a perfect democratic society. They take everybody's input, and then they make a group decision, and the group decision is for the betterment of the whole, and they thrive by each doing a little tiny bit of contribution and work.
As a fifth-generation beekeeper, May continues to care for her family's progeny of bees. You can learn more about this topic and our guest, Meredith May, by heading to viewpointsradio.org. This segment originally aired in May 2019 and was written by Polly Hansen. Our executive producer is Amira Zaveri. Our studio manager is Jason Dickey. I'm Marty Peterson.
Viewpoints returns in just a moment.
Did you know that feeling sluggish or weighed down could be a sign that your digestive system isn't working at its best? Taking Metamucil every day can help. Metamucil fiber powders help promote your daily digestive health using a plant-based fiber called psyllium. The gelling action of this special fiber traps and removes waste so you can feel lighter and more energetic. Metamucil, promoting digestive health for a better you. Learn more at Metamucil.com.